had hundreds more items to photograph and post on the website, but enough had been completed to justify the site going live. It was, in any case, always going to be a work in progress if they continued to gather things that other people had lost. There was going to be an item in the local newspaper that week, and Laura had already given an interview to the local radio station. There were now only days to go before the website went live. "What if no one comes forward to claim anything?" worried Laura, chewing nervously on her fingernail. Freddie playfully slapped her hand away from her mouth.
"Of course they will," he said. "Won't they, Sunshine?"
Sunshine shrugged her shoulders dramatically, her bottom lip pouting like a ship's prow. She poured the tea and plonked the cups and saucers down in front of them hard. Freddie raised his hands in surrender.
"Okay, okay. I give up. What's up, kid?"
Sunshine put her hands on her hips and treated them both to her sternest look.
"No one ever listens to me," she said quietly.
They were now. Her words dropped into the air and hung there, expectantly, waiting for a response. Neither Freddie nor Laura knew what to say. Each felt a prickle of guilt that Sunshine might actually have a point. With her diminutive stature and ingenuous features, it was easy to slip into the habit of treating her like a child and weighting her opinions and ideas accordingly. But Sunshine was a young woman, albeit dancing drome, and perhaps it was about time that they started treating her as such. "We're sorry," said Laura. Freddie nodded, for once without a trace of a smile on his face. "We're sorry if you've tried to talk to us and we haven't listened."
"Yes," said Freddie. "And if we do it again, just bash us."
Sunshine thought about it for a moment, and then clipped him round the ear, just for good measure. Then, serious again, she addressed them both.
"It's not the ring. It's the letter."
"Which letter?" said Freddie.
"St. Anthony's dead letter," she replied. "Come on," she added.
They followed her from the kitchen into the garden room, where she picked up the Al Bowley record and placed it on the turntable.
"It's the letter," she said again.
And with that, she set the needle down onto the disc, and the music began to play.
Chapter 40, Eunice, 2005.
"The thought of you publishing that..."
Eunice consulted her inner omnibus of obscenities and, finding nothing suitably disparaging, expostulated her final word like a poisonous blow dart. "Thing!" The hardback floozy of a book with its trashy red and gold cover languished half-undressed in its brown paper wrappings alongside a bottle of champagne that Bruce had sent with it, according to the card, as some consolation for not having the wit to publish it yourself. Bomber shook his head in bewildered disbelief. "I haven't even read it. Have you?" Portia's latest book had topped the bestseller lists for the past 3 weeks, and as its publisher, Bruce's swaggering peacockery knew no restraint. His self-importance was index-linked to his bank balance, which, thanks to Portia, now warranted a platinum credit card and first-name terms with the branch manager.
"Of course I've read it," Eunice exclaimed. "I had to, in order to slander it from an informed perspective. I've also read all the reviews. You do realise that your sister's book is being hailed as a searing satire on the saccharine clichés of contemporary commercial fiction? One critic called it a razor-sharp deconstruction of the sexual balance of power in modern relationships, pushing the boundaries of popular literature to exhilarating extremes and giving the finger to those luminaries of the literary establishment who habitually kowtow to the conventions of Man Booker and its staid stablemates." Despite her fury, Eunice couldn't keep a straight face, and Bomber was in stitches.
He eventually composed himself sufficiently to ask, "But what's it about?" Eunice sighed. "Oh, do you really want to know? It's so much worse than anything else she's ever done." "I think I can cope. Well, as you are already painfully aware, it goes by the intriguing title of Harriet Hotter and the Gobstopper Phone." Eunice paused for effect. "Harriet, orphaned at an early age and raised by a dreadful aunt and a clinically obese and very sweaty uncle, vows to leave their home as soon as she can and make her own way in the world. After her A-levels, she gets a job in a pizza and kebab shop, Pizbab, near King's Cross, where she is constantly mocked for her posh voice and her bifocal spectacles. One day, an old man with a very long beard and a funny hat comes into the shop to buy a kebab and chips and tells her that she is very special. He hands her a business card and tells her to call him. Fast forward 6 months and Harriet is earning a small fortune from phone sex. Her customers love her because she has a posh voice, as though her cheeks were stuffed with gobstoppers. And so the ingenious title is explained. Our heroine, not satisfied with mere financial reward, seeks self-fulfilment and enhanced job satisfaction. In partnership with the beardy old man, a.k.a. Chester Fumblefore, she sets up a training school for aspiring phone sex workers called Snogwarts, so called because Harriet teaches her students to speak to every customer as though he were a handsome prince, even though most of them are more likely to be warty toads. Among her first pupils are Persephone Danger and Donna Sleazy, who become her best friends and training assistants. Between them, they set up a vast call centre where their pupils can earn an honest living while they are training. Harriet invents a game called Quids In to increase productivity and raise morale in the workplace. The winner, who receives a cash bonus and a month's supply of gobstoppers, is the worker who satisfies the most customers in 1 hour, whilst cunningly introducing the words brothel, todger, twice, and golden snatch into each phone sex liaison. Bomber laughed out loud. "It's not funny, Bomber," exploded Eunice. "It's an absolute bloody disgrace. How can anybody give such utter drivel shelf room? Millions of people are paying hard-earned money for this excrement. It's not even well-written excrement. It's execrable excrement. And if it's not enough that Portia's being interviewed on every poxy chat show that's aired, there's a horribly tenacious rumour doing the rounds about her being invited to speak at the Hay Festival this year." Bomber clapped his hands in glee. "Now that I should gladly pay good money to see." Eunice shot him a warning look and he shrugged his shoulders in reply. "How could I resist? I'm just thankful that Ma and Pa aren't around to witness the whole ruddy circus, especially with Ma having been the chairwoman of the local WI. Bomber chuckled to himself at the thought of it, but then donned a more appropriately serious expression for his next question. "Now, I'm almost afraid to ask, but I probably need to know. Is it terribly explicit?" Eunice let out a hoot of derision. "Explicit? Remember that time when Bruce was here ranting on about that Purdue chap and lecturing us on the key components of a bestseller?" Bomber nodded. "And he told us, and I quote, that the sex should never be too outré." Bomber nodded again, more slowly this time. "Well, unless his definition of outré is informed by a far more adventurous carnal relationship with Brunhilde than we ever gave them credit for, I think he's changed his mind." Bomber placed his hands on the small wooden box that stood next to Douglas's on his desk and warned, "Cover your ears and don't listen to this, Baby Jane." Eunice smiled a little sadly and continued, "One of Harriet's customers has sex with a bread-making machine. Another lusts after women with beards, hairy backs and ingrowing toenails. And yet another has his testicles bathed in surgical spirit and then stroked with the mane of a My Little Pony. And that's only chapter two." Bomber picked up the book from its wrappings and opened the front cover, to be greeted by a glossy photograph of his sister, wearing a self-satisfied smile
and a silk negligee. He snapped it shut again with a resounding thump.
Well, at least she didn't simply steal someone else's plot wholesale this time. She did make some of it up herself.
Let's hope so, said Eunice. The next day, all thoughts of Portia were purged by the glittering aquamarine waves and warm, salty wind of Brighton seafront. It was the annual outing, and this was the first without Douglas or Baby Jane. They had been coming every year since Eunice's 21st birthday trip with Bomber, and the day followed a familiar pattern that had been fine-tuned over the years to provide enjoyment and entertainment to all members of their small party. First, they walked along the promenade. In the past, when Douglas and then Baby Jane had accompanied them, the dogs had gloried in the compliments and cosseting of passers-by that they inevitably attracted. Then there was the visit to the pier, and an hour frittered away on the flashing, clanging, jangling slot machines. Then lunch of fish and chips, and a bottle of pink fizz, and finally the Royal Pavilion. But as they strolled towards the pier, worry was washing away Eunice's happiness. Bomber had asked her twice in the space of 10 minutes, if they'd been there before. The first time she'd hoped he was joking, but the second time she looked at his face, and her world tipped sharply on its axis when she saw an expression of innocence and genuine inquiry. It was horribly, gut-wrenchingly familiar. Godfrey. He was following his father's painful footsteps to a destination Eunice couldn't bear to think about. So far it was barely noticeable, a hairline crack in his solid, dependable sanity. But Eunice knew that in time he would be as vulnerable as a name written in the sand at the mercy of an incoming tide. As yet, Bomber seemed unaware of his gentle unravelings. Like a man with petit mal, he passed through them, blithely oblivious. But Eunice lived them all, second by second, and her heart was already breaking. The coloured lights and bells and buzzers of the pier's amusement arcade welcomed them in to waste their money. Eunice left Bomber standing by a 2-penny slot machine, watching lanes of tightly packed coins shunting back and forth, to see which would tip over the edge, while she went to fetch some change. When she returned, she found him like a lost child, coin in hand, staring at the coin slot on the machine, but completely unable to fathom the connection between the two. Gently, she took the coin from him and dropped it into the slot, and his face lit up as he watched a pile of coins tip and fall, rattling into the metal tray beneath. The rest of the day passed happily and uneventfully. For the first time, as they were without a canine companion, they were able to sample the exotic delights of the pavilion interior together, where they oohed and aahed their amazement at the chandeliers and clucked their disgust at the spit roaster in the kitchen, which was originally driven by an unfortunate dog. As they sat on a bench in the gardens, basking in the coral light of the late afternoon sun, Bomber took Eunice's hand and let out a sigh of blissful contentment Eunice remembered to treasure.
"This place is utterly fabulous."
Chapter 41. The navy blue leather glove belonged to a dead woman. Not the most promising of starts for the keeper of lost things. The day after the website launched, a retired reporter had emailed. For many years, she had worked for the local newspaper, and she remembered it well. It was the first proper news item she had covered.
It made the front page. The poor woman was only in her 30s. She threw herself in front of a train. The train driver was in a terrible state, poor bloke. He was new to his job, too. He'd only been driving solo for a couple of weeks. Her name was Rose. She was ill, what they called bad nerves back then. I remember she had a little girl. Such a pretty little thing. Rose had a picture of her in her coat pocket. They printed it in the paper with the story. I wasn't very comfortable with that, but I was overruled by the editor. I went to her funeral. It was a gruesome business altogether. Not much of a body left to bury. But the photo was still in the pocket of her coat, and she was wearing only one glove. It's such a small detail, but it seemed so poignant. And it was so cold that night. That must be why I've remembered it for all these years.
It was the glove Sunshine had dropped in horror when it had fallen out of the drawer. She had said at the time, "The lady died," and "She loved her little girl." Laura was dumbfounded. It seemed that Sunshine was right, and once again they had been guilty of underestimating her. She had a very special gift, and they would do well to listen to her a bit more carefully. Sunshine had read the email impassively. Her only comment had been, "Perhaps her little girl will want it back." Sunshine was out with Carrot. She went out most days now to gather more lost things for the website, carrying a small notebook and pencil so that she could jot down the details for the labels before she forgot. Freddy was out laying a new lawn for one of his customers, so Laura was alone, except for Therese. I know, she said out loud. I'm going to look for it today, I promise. Since Sunshine's revelation that Anthony's letter was the clue they needed, Laura had been trying to remember where she had put it. At first, she thought that she might have left it in the dressing table in Therese's room, but the door remained locked, so she hadn't been able to check. In any case, it hardly seemed likely that Therese would be preventing her from finding the very thing that she wanted her to find. Even she couldn't be that awkward. Laura went into the study. She would just check the emails first. The website was proving popular, with hundreds of hits already. There were two emails. One was from an elderly lady who said that she was 89 years of age and a silver surfer of 2 years, thanks to her local retirement centre. She had heard about the website on the radio and decided to take a look. She thought that a jigsaw puzzle piece found years ago in Copper Street might be hers, or rather, her sister's. They hadn't got on, and one day, when her sister had been particularly vicious, she had taken a piece from the puzzle her sister was working on. She went for a walk to get out of the house and threw the piece into the gutter.
"Childish, I expect," she said, "but she could be the very devil. And she was livid when she found that it was missing."
The old lady didn't want it back. Her sister was long dead anyway. But it was nice, she said, to have something to practice her emails on. The second was from a young woman claiming a lime green hair bobble. Her mum had bought the bobbles for her to cheer her up the day before she started a new school she was feeling nervous about. She'd lost one in the park on the way home from a day out with her mum, and it would be nice to have it back as a memento. Laura replied to both emails, and then set about searching for Anthony's letter. By the time Sunshine returned with Carrot, Laura was poring over the letter at the kitchen table. She had found it tucked away in the writing desk in the garden room. As soon as she had found it, she had helpfully remembered that, of course, that was where she had placed it for safekeeping. Sunshine made the lovely cup of tea for them, and then sat down next to Laura.
"What does it say?" she asked.
"What does what say?"
said Freddy, bursting through the back door, his boots covered in mud. Laura and Sunshine both looked at his feet and commanded in unison, "Off!" Freddy laughed as he struggled out of his boots and left them outside on the doormat.
"Talk about hempecked," he exclaimed. "Now, what's all this?"
"It's Saint Anthony's dead letter, and now we're going to find the clue," Sunshine exclaimed with far more confidence than Laura felt.
She began to read out loud, but resurgent grief choked his generous words in her throat before she could even finish the first line. Sunshine took the letter gently from her and began again, reading slowly and deliberately, helped by Freddy with some of the more difficult words. When she reached the final paragraph, where Anthony asked Laura to befriend her, her face lit up with a smile. "But I asked you first," she said. Laura took her hand. "And I'm very glad you did," she replied. Freddy slapped his palms on the table.
"Enough with the mushy stuff, you girls," he said, rocking his chair backwards on two legs. "What's the clue?"
Sunshine looked at him with dutiful amusement, which quickly withered into undisguised scorn when she realized that he wasn't joking.
"You cannot be serious," she said, looking to Laura for support.
"Well, it could be anything," Laura ventured uncertainly. Freddy was studying the letter again.
"Well, come on, John McEnroe," he said to Sunshine. "Enlighten us."
Sunshine sighed, and like a schoolteacher sorely disappointed with her class, she shook her head slowly before announcing,
"It's so obvious."
And when she explained, they realized that, of course, it was.
Chapter 42. Eunice. 2011. Today was a good day, but the term was only relative. No day now was truly good. The best that Eunice could hope for were a few bewildered smiles, an occasional recollection of who she was, and most of all, no tears from the man she had spent most of her adult life in love with. She strolled arm in arm with Bomber around the bleak patchwork of bare earth and concrete paving slabs that the officer in charge of the Happy Haven care home grandiosely termed the Rose Garden. The only trace of the roses were a few bent brown sticks poking out of the earth like the detritus of a bushfire. Eunice could easily have wept. And this was a good day. Bomber had wanted to go to Folly's End. Before he was too often lost in random bouts of oblivion, but knew that to be his inevitable fate, he had made his wishes clear. He had always intended to give Eunice his power of attorney when the time came, and thus salvage whatever scraps of dignity and security that could be wrung from a future as bleak as the one he faced. He could trust Eunice with his life, however worthless it might become. She would always do the right thing, but Portia got there first. Armed with ridiculous but omnipotent wealth, and next of kin affiliation, if not affection, she tricked Bomber into seeing a specialist, who no doubt, with her financial encouragement, legally declared him to be no longer capable of making rational decisions, and turned his future welfare over to his sister. The following week, Bomber was installed at Happy Haven. Eunice had fought his corner as hard as she could. She had argued ferociously for Folly's End, but Portia was unmoved. Folly's End was too far away for her to conveniently visit, and in any case, she claimed with astonishing callousness, it was only a matter of time before Bomber wouldn't have a clue where he was anyway. But for now he did, and it was killing him. Surprisingly, Portia did visit him, but they were strained, uncomfortable encounters. She veered wildly between bossing him about and cowering fearfully away from him. His reaction to both approaches was the same, painful bewilderment. Having deprived him of the one thing he wanted, she showered him with expensive, often pointless gifts. He had no idea what the espresso machine was, let alone how to work it. He poured the designer aftershave down the toilet and used the fancy camera as a doorstop. In the end, Portia spent most of the time, during her visits, drinking tea with Sylvia, the sycophantic officer in charge who was a devoted fan of the Harriet Hotter books, of which there was now, regrettably, a trilogy. Eunice did her best to make Bomber's room a little piece of home. She brought things from his flat, and put photographs of Douglas and Baby Jane on every shelf and table. But it wasn't enough. He was drifting away, giving up. Eunice and Bomber were not alone in the garden. Eulalia was feeding a magpie with bits of toast she'd saved from her breakfast. She was an ancient, wizened husk of a woman, with skin the colour of stewed prunes, wild eyes, and an alarming cackle. Her twisted hands clutched knobbled walking sticks that she used to anchor and propel herself in a jerky, shuffling gait. Most of the other residents avoided her, but Bomber always greeted her with a friendly wave. Round and round they walked, mindlessly like prisoners in an exercise yard. Eunice, because she couldn't bear to think, and Bomber, just because most of the time he couldn't. Eulalia threw her last piece of toast at the black-and-white bird, who snatched it from the ground and gobbled it down, never taking his bright elderberry eyes off Eulalia. She shook her stick at him and squawked. "Off with you now, away before they put you in the pot for dinner." "They would, you know," she said, turning to Eunice, and screwing one of her eyes into a grotesque wink. "They feeds us all kinds of shit in here." Judging by the smell from the kitchen, which was wafting into the garden through an open window, Eunice had to concede that she might have a point.
"Him nuts, that one," said Eulalia,
waggling a hooked claw at Bomber, whilst somehow still managing to keep hold of the walking stick.
"Mad as an ant with his arse on fire."
She planted her sticks onto the concrete and began her painful, awkward shuffle back to the house.
"But him a lovely man inside," she said to Eunice as she passed. "Lovely, but dying."
Back in Bomber's room, Eunice threw back the curtains to let in what little light the pale winter sun could spare. It was a nice room on the second floor, clean and spacious, with rather grand French windows and a pretty balcony, which Bomber wasn't allowed to use. Eunice had opened them the first time that she had visited Bomber. It was a sultry summer day, and the room was hot and stuffy. The key had been left in the lock, but an officious care assistant who had come in to check on Bomber banged the windows shut and locked the key in the medicine cabinet on the wall in Bomber's room.
"Health and safety," she had spat at Eunice.
After that day, Eunice never saw the key again. "Let's watch a film, shall we?" Bomber smiled. For him, now, his own life story was like an unbound manuscript, badly edited. Some of the pages were in the wrong order, some torn, some rewritten or missing altogether. The original version was lost to him forever. But he still found pleasure in the familiar stories told in the old films that they had watched so many times together. There were more days now when he didn't know his own name or what he'd just eaten for breakfast. But he could still quote word for word from The Great Escape, Brief Encounter, Top Gun, and scores of other films. "What about this one?" said Eunice, holding up a copy of The Birdcage. He looked up and smiled, and for a precious, fleeting moment the mists cleared.
"My birthday present," he said,
and Eunice knew that her Bomber was still in there.
Chapter 43. "He's still in there," said Sunshine in a worried voice. Carrot had taken up a sentinel post in the shed, having caught a whiff of a resident rodent, and Sunshine was growing increasingly anxious that Carrot's lunch might have mouse on the menu. Laura was in the study, retrieving an item someone had contacted the website about, and was coming to collect that afternoon. "Don't worry, Sunshine. I'm sure the mouse will have the good sense not to show a single whisker while Carrot's in there." Sunshine was unconvinced. "But he might, and then Carrot would kill him and be a murderinger." Laura smiled. She knew Sunshine well enough by now to know that she wouldn't give up until something was done. 2 minutes later, Laura was back, towing a recalcitrant Carrot on his lead. In the kitchen, she gave him a sausage from the fridge and unclipped his lead. Before Sunshine could raise an objection, Laura pacified her. "Mickey or Minnie will be quite safe now. I've shut the shed door, and now he's had a sausage, Carrot won't be hungry anyway."
"He's
always hungry," muttered Sunshine, as she watched Carrot slope out of the room with mischief still clearly on his mind.
"When's the lady coming?" she asked.
Laura checked her watch. "Any time now. She's called Alice, and I thought you might like to make the lovely cup of tea when she gets here." As if on cue, the bell rang, and Sunshine was at the front door before Laura was out of the starting blocks.
"Good afternoon, Lady Alice,"
Sunshine greeted the rather taken aback teenager at the door.
"I'm Sunshine. Please do come in."
"What a great name." The girl who followed Sunshine into the hall was tall and slim, with long fair hair and a splatter of freckles across her nose. Laura held out her hand. "Hi, I'm Laura. Lovely to meet you." Sunshine deftly commandeered Alice and took her through to the garden, while Laura was left to make the tea. When she came out with the tray of tea things, she found Alice and Sunshine swapping musical heroes.
"We both love David Bowie,"
Sunshine announced proudly to Laura as she began to pour the tea.
"I'm sure he'll be delighted," said Laura, smiling.
"How do you take it?" she asked Alice. "Builders for me, please." Sunshine looked worried.
"I don't know if we've got any of that, have we?" she asked Laura.
"Don't worry, Sunshine," said Alice, quick to spot her discomfort. "It's just me being silly. I meant nice and strong with milk and two sugars." Alice had come to collect an umbrella. A child's umbrella. White with red hearts. "I didn't actually lose it," she explained, "and I can't be absolutely certain that it was meant for me." Sunshine picked up the umbrella that was already on the table and handed it to her.
"It was," she said simply.
Although, judging by the look of undisguised adoration on Sunshine's face, Laura reckoned she would have given Alice the family silver without a second thought and thrown in the deeds to Padua for good measure. Alice took the umbrella from her and stroked its folded ruffles. "It was my first time in America," she told them. "Mum took me to New York. It was more of a working holiday for her. She was an editor of a fashion magazine, and she'd bagged an interview with a hotshot new designer who was tipped to be the next big thing on the New York fashion scene. He was, as it turned out. But all I remember about him then was that he looked at me like I'd escaped from a leper colony or something. Apparently he didn't do children."
"What's a leopard colony?" Sunshine asked.
Alice looked over to Laura, but then decided to wing it anyway. "It's a place where, in olden times, they used to put people who had a terrible illness that made their fingers and toes drop off." Laura would have bet money that Sunshine spent the next 5 minutes surreptitiously counting Alice's digits. Thank goodness she was wearing sandals. "There wasn't much time for sightseeing," Alice continued. "But she promised to take me to see the sculpture of Alice in Wonderland in Central Park. I remember being utterly thrilled. I thought that the statue was named after me." She slipped off her sandals and wriggled her toes in the cool grass. Sunshine studiously followed suit. "It was raining that afternoon, and Mum was already running late for her next appointment, so she wasn't in the best of tempers. But I was beyond excited. I ran off ahead of her, and when I got to the sculpture, there was this huge, strange-looking black guy with dreadlocks and big boots giving away umbrellas. He bent down and shook hands with me, and I can still remember his face. It was a mixture of kind and sad, and he was called Marvin." Alice drained her cup and helped herself to another from the pot with confident teenage ease. "My favourite story at the time was The Selfish Giant by Oscar Wilde, and to me, Marvin looked like a giant. But he wasn't selfish. He was giving things away. Free umbrellas. Anyway, when Mum caught up with me, she dragged me away. But it wasn't just that. She was rude to him, really horrible. He tried to give her an umbrella, and she was an absolute bitch. Sunshine's eyebrows hiccuped in astonishment at the casual use of an expletive, but her expression was one of admiration. I only met him for a moment, but I've never been able to forget the look on his face as she dragged me away. She sighed heavily, but then smiled as another memory eclipsed the last. I blew him a kiss, she said, and he caught it. The date on the umbrella's label matched the exact day of Alice's visit to Central Park, and the umbrella was found on the sculpture. Laura was delighted. I think it must have been meant for you. I really hope so, said Alice. For the rest of the day, Carrot lay guarding the door of the shed, and Sunshine talked about her new friend, Alice. Alice was at university, studying English literature and drama. Alice liked David Bowie, Mark Bolan, and John Bonhovis, and the lovely cup of tea had been similarly supplanted by the builder's variety. That evening, over a late supper of spaghetti bolognese, Laura told Freddy all about their visitor.
It's working then, said Freddy. The website. It's doing what Anthony wanted you to do.
Laura shook her head. No, not really. Not yet, anyway. Remember what the letter said? If you can make just one person happy, mend one broken heart by restoring to them what they have lost. And I haven't done that yet. Of course, Alice was pleased to find the umbrella, but we can't be absolutely sure that it was meant for her. And the girl with the hair bubble, her heart wasn't exactly broken when she lost it.
Well, at least it's a start, said Freddy, pushing back his chair and getting up to take Carrot for a final stroll around the garden before bed. We'll get there in the end.
But it wasn't just about the lost things. There was the clue, the one that was so obvious once Sunshine had pointed it out, the thing that had started all this. Anthony had called it the last remaining thread that had bound him to Therese. And when he lost it on the day she died, that final thread was broken. If her communion medal really was the key to reuniting Therese with Anthony, how on earth were they supposed to find it? Freddy had suggested that they post it on the website as a lost item needing to be found. But as they had no idea what it looked like or where Anthony had lost it, there was very little useful information that they could share. Laura cleared the plates from the table. It had been a long day, and she was tired. The satisfaction that she had felt after Alice's visit had gradually dissipated, only to be replaced by a familiar feeling of unease. And in the garden room, the music began again.
Chapter 44. Eunice. 2013. In the residence lounge at Happy Haven, the music began again. Mantovani's Charmaine. Quietly at first, and then louder and louder. Too loud. Edie turned the volume up as high as it would go. Soon she would be gliding round the ballroom to the strings' glissandos, in a froth of net and sparkles. Her feet would spin and sweep in her best gold dancing sandals, and the glittering lights would swirl around her like a snowstorm of rainbows. As Eunice and Bomber passed through the lounge on the way to Bomber's room, they saw a ragged bundle of nightclothes, barely inhabited by a thin, whiskery old woman with a greasy straggle of grey hair and tartan slippers. She was stumbling round the room with her eyes closed and her arms lovingly wrapped around some invisible partner. Suddenly, there was an explosion of sticks and expletives from one of the armchairs.
"Not again! Jesus fucking Christ and Jehovah, not again! Not again! Not again!"
Eulalia had burst out of her chair, cursing and thrashing.
"Not a fucking again, you stupid, crazy, dirty bitch! Me just want a bit of peace!" she roared.
flinging one of her sticks at the dancer, who had stopped in her tracks. The stick missed Edie by a mile, but she let out an anguished yowl as tears began to course down her cheeks and urine down her legs and into her slippers. Eulalia had struggled to her feet and was pointing with one of her claws. "Now she piss herself, piss her pants, piss the floor," she cackled furiously through spittle-flecked lips. Eunice tried to move Bomber on, but he was frozen to the spot. Some of the other residents had begun shouting or crying, and others stared into the distance, oblivious, or pretending to be. It took two members of staff to restrain Eulalia, as Sylvia led poor Edie away. She was trembling and snivelling, and dripping piss from the hem of her nightgown, as she shuffled out miserably, clinging to Sylvia's arm, and wondering where on earth the ballroom had gone. Back in the safety of Bomber's room, Eunice made him a cup of tea. As she drank her own, she took in the new additions to Bomber's growing collection of swag. He had begun stealing things. Random items that he didn't need. A vase, a tea cosy, cutlery, rolls of plastic bin bags, umbrellas. He never stole from the rooms of other residents, just from the communal areas. It was a symptom of his disease, apparently. Petty theft. But he was losing things, too. Thick and fast now, he was losing words like a tree loses leaves in the autumn. A bed might be a soft sleep square, and a pencil, a stick with grey middle, writing coming out. Instead of words, he spoke in clues, or more often, not at all. Eunice suggested that they watch a film. It was all that was left of them now. Eunice and Bomber, who for so long had been colleagues and best friends. Bomber's occasional boyfriends had come and gone, but Eunice was his constant. They were husband and wife without sex or certificate, and these were the last paltry scraps of their once rich relationship, walking and watching films. Bomber chose the film. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. "Are you sure?" Eunice asked. She had been hoping for something a little more jolly for her own sake and for his, after what they had just witnessed. Bomber was adamant. As they watched the patients at the state mental hospital, walking in the chain-link-fenced exercise yard, Bomber pointed at the screen and winked at her. "That's us," he said. Eunice looked into his eyes and was shocked to see the clarity reflected back at her. This was the Bomber of old speaking, sharp, funny, bright, and back for a rare visit. But for how long? Even the briefest visit was precious but heartbreaking. Heartbreaking because he must know that he would have to go back. And to what? It was a film that they had watched many times before, but this time it was very different. As the chief placed the pillow over Mac's pitifully vacant face and tenderly suffocated him, Bomber gripped Eunice's hand and spoke his final three words.
"Get me out."
He was calling in her promise. Eunice stared at the screen and held on tight to Bomber's hand as the giant chief wrenched the marble water cooler from the tubroom floor, hurled it through the massive windows, and then loped off towards the breaking dawn and freedom. As the credits rolled, Eunice couldn't move. Bomber took her other hand in his. His eyes were full of tears, but he was smiling as he nodded and mouthed silently at her, "Please." Before Eunice could say anything, one of the nurses burst in without knocking.
"Time for your medication," she bustled, rattling the keys to the medicine cabinet on the wall.
She unlocked it and was just reaching for the tablets when there was a terrified scream from the corridor outside, followed by Eulalia's unmistakable cackle.
"That damn woman,"
cursed the nurse, rushing to the door to investigate.
and leaving the cabinet unlocked. It was time for Eunice to go. She must leave. But until she did, she still had Bomber, and so she couldn't bear to go. But every minute was just a marker between now and then, not time to be cherished. Because the decision had been made. Eunice knew that there would be only one chance. One moment when all the love she had ever felt for this man would crystallize into the inconceivable strength that she would need. It was time. The imprint of the key was embedded into the flesh of her palm, where she had gripped it so tightly. Eunice unlocked the windows and opened them, leaving them just ajar. She wanted so desperately to hug him one last time, to hold his warmth, and feel him breathing against her. But she knew that if she did, her strength would desert her. So instead, she placed the key in his hand and kissed his cheek. "I'm not going without you, Bomber," she whispered. "I wouldn't leave you this way. You're coming with me. Let's go." And then she left. Chapter 45. Elderly male in death fall at care home. Police are investigating the death of an elderly male resident of the Happy Haven care home in Blackheath, who fell from a second-floor balcony early on Saturday evening. The man, who has not yet been named, was suffering from Alzheimer's and is believed to have been a retired publisher. A post-mortem is due to be carried out later this week, and police inquiries into what they are calling an unexplained death are ongoing. London Evening Standard.
Chapter 46. "There's a dead person in the study," Sunshine announced in a conversational tone. She had come to find Laura, who was in the garden cutting roses for the house, to tell her this piece of news and to chivvy her along into making lunch. Carrot was lolling lazily on his back in the sun, with his legs in the air, but as Sunshine approached, he jumped up to greet her. It had been a year now since the website had launched, and it kept both Laura and Sunshine busy. Sunshine had learned how to take photographs and post them and the details of objects onto the website, and Freddie had even shown her how to run a Keeper of Lost Things Instagram account. Laura dealt with the emails. They were still working their way through Anthony's collection, as well as adding the new things that Sunshine gathered on her walks with Carrot. Laura and Freddie had also got into the habit of picking up things they found wherever they went, and now people had begun to send them lost items as well. At this rate, the shelves in the study would always be groaning. "A dead person? Are you sure?" Sunshine gave her one of her looks. Laura went inside to investigate. In the study, Sunshine showed her a sky blue Huntley & Palmer's biscuit tin. Its label read,
"Huntley and Palmer's biscuit tin, containing cremation remains? Found 6th carriage from the front, 1442 train, from London Bridge to Brighton. Deceased unknown. God bless and rest in peace. Lupin and Bootle Funeral Directors, established 1927, was on the corner of a busy street, opposite a fancy bakery. As she stood outside, Eunice smiled to herself, remembering Mrs. Doyle's and thinking that this was an appropriate place for Bomber to end up. He had been dead for 6 weeks now, and Eunice still hadn't had any details about his funeral. The coroner had eventually returned a verdict of accidental death, but the staff at Happy Haven had been severely criticized for their cavalier approach to health and safety procedures, and had only narrowly escaped prosecution. Portia had wanted Sylvia's head in a bedpan. She had been mourning extravagantly all over the press and the media, but Eunice couldn't help wondering whether it was fueled by genuine grief or the associated publicity it was bound to generate for her forthcoming book tour. Portia was too famous to talk to Eunice directly now. She had assistants for that kind of trivial task. which was why Eunice found herself staring through an immaculate plate-glass window at a scale model of a horse-drawn hearse and a tasteful display of arum lilies. The only information she had been able to extract from the lowliest assistant, twice removed, was the name of the funeral directors who were dealing with all inquiries. She could have telephoned, but the temptation to be in the same building as Bomber was too great. The woman behind the reception desk looked up at the sound of the bell and gave Eunice a smile of genuine welcome. Pauline was a large lady, dressed in Marks and Spencer's finest, with an air of capability and kindness. She put Eunice in mind of a brown owl. Unfortunately, the news she had to deliver was the cruelest and most shocking that Eunice could possibly hear. It was very small, family only at the crematorium. The sister organised it, the one who writes those mucky books. It was clear from the repugnance with which Pauline imbued the word sister that she and Portia had not exactly bonded. Eunice felt her head go into a tailspin and the floor rise up to meet her. Not long afterwards, she was sitting on a comfy sofa drinking hot sweet tea with a nip of brandy, and Pauline was patting her hand. "It was the shock, love," she said. "Your face went as white as a ghost." Fortified by tea, brandy and biscuits, Eunice was made party to the whole dreadful story by a very forthcoming Pauline. Portia had wanted it done and dusted as quickly and quietly as possible. She was off on her book tour, you see, and she didn't want her schedule disrupted. Pauline took a sip of her own tea and shook her head vigorously in disapproval. "But she's having a proper showy-off shebang when she gets back. A memorial service and then a burial of the ashes. She's inviting everyone who is anyone, darling, and the music will be provided by choirs of angels, with His Holiness the Pope presiding, by the way she was talking. It'll knock Princess Diana's do into a cocked hat, apparently." Eunice listened in horror. "But that wasn't what he wanted at all," she whispered tearfully. "He told me what he wanted. He was the love of my life." And now, right at the last, she was going to fail him. Pauline was good at listening and mopping up tears. It was her job. But deep inside, her sensible suit and her easy iron blouse beat the brave heart of a maverick. Back in the day, her blonde barb had been a pink Mohican, and her nose still bore the tiny scar of a safety pin piercing. She handed Eunice another tissue. "All the boys are out at a big funeral this afternoon. I wouldn't normally do this, but follow me." She led Eunice through from the reception area, down a corridor, past the staff kitchen, the chapel of rest, and various other rooms to the place where the cremation remains were stored awaiting collection. From one of the shelves she took down an impressive wooden urn and checked the label. "Here he is," she said gently. She checked her watch. "I'm going to leave you alone with him for a bit to pay your respects. The boys won't be back for another hour, so you won't be disturbed." Less than an hour later, Eunice was sitting on a train with Bomber's ashes in a Huntley and Palmer's biscuit tin on the seat beside her. She had had to think and act fast after Pauline had left her. She found a plastic carrier bag and a biscuit tin in the little kitchen where Pauline had made tea. She emptied the biscuits into the bag and then tipped Bomber into the biscuit tin. She refilled the urn with the biscuits, but it was too light. Frantically searching for additional ballast, she found a box of decorative gravel samples in one of the other rooms. She threw in a couple of large handfuls and then screwed the lid back on as tightly as she could and returned the urn to its shelf. As she made her way out through the reception area, clutching the biscuit tin, Pauline didn't look up from her desk, but raised her thumbs to Eunice in a good luck gesture. She hadn't seen a thing. As the guard blew his whistle, Eunice patted the tin affectionately and smiled. Brighton it is.
Laura was astonished. She picked up the tin and gave it a gentle shake. It was certainly heavy.
Don't shake it, said Sunshine. You'll wake him up.
And then she giggled at her own joke. Laura was wondering what else might be lurking in the dark corners of the study. No wonder this place is haunted, she said to Sunshine. After lunch, Laura helped her to post the details on the website. But this was one thing she was fairly certain no one would come forward to claim. That evening, Freddy, Laura, Sunshine, Carrot, Stella and Stan had a celebratory dinner in the garden of The Moon Is Missing to mark the birthday of the website. Sunshine was full of stories about all the things that were currently posted, but most especially about the biscuit tin. It's certainly a queer thing to lose, said Stella, tucking into her crumb-dusted sautéed crayfish tails with hand-cut chips. And why on earth would you put your loved one in a biscuit tin?
Perhaps that's just it, love, said Stan. Perhaps the bloke in the tin wasn't particularly loved and someone was just trying to get rid of him. Perhaps it's not human remains at all. Maybe it's just the sweepings out of somebody's fireplace. That's exactly what it looks like, said Freddy, taking a long swig of his ice-cold beer.
Sunshine was about to remonstrate with him when he winked at her, and she realized he was only joking.
It is a dead person, and he was the love of her life, and she will come and get him, she replied defiantly.
Okay, he replied. Let's have a bet. What do you want to bet me that someone will come and get the biscuit tin?
Sunshine screwed up her face in concentration and fed Carrot a couple of chips while she was thinking about it. Suddenly, a huge smile lit up her face and she leaned back in her chair and folded her arms across her chest with a sigh of victorious satisfaction.
You have to marry Laura.
Laura spilled her wine in shock.
Steady on, old girl, said Stan. Blimey, Sunshine, you certainly know how to frighten the horses.
Laura could feel her face reddening. Stella and Stan were chuckling merrily, and Sunshine was grinning from ear to ear. Laura wished that the ground would open up and swallow her, and so swallowed her wine too quickly and ordered another large glass. Freddy said nothing. He looked as though he was somewhere between annoyed and disappointed. But then when he saw Laura's face, he leapt to his feet and thrust his hand out to Sunshine.
It's a bet.
It was hot that night, and the air was heavy with the warm velvet scent of roses as Freddy and Laura wandered round the garden while Carrot searched the shrubbery for intruders. Laura was still fretting about the bet that Freddy had made. He had been very quiet on the way home from the pub. Although they had been together for a little over a year, and Freddy virtually lived at Padua now, they had never made any real plans for the future. She counted herself very lucky to have a second chance at both life and love, but she was still afraid that any attempt, however light-hearted, to tether their relationship might cause love to bolt. And she did love him. Not in the silly, girlish way that she had been infatuated with Vince. This had, for her, grown stealthily into an abiding love, sparked first by passion and then sustained by friendship and trust. But alongside her love for Freddy grew the fear of losing him. The two emotions cruelly shackled together, each feeding the other. Laura had to say something. That bet with Sunshine, it's just a joke. I don't expect you to. She was so uncomfortable that she didn't know how to continue. It suddenly dawned on her that marrying Freddy might be exactly what she wanted, and that was why she was so upset. Her foolish hopes of a happy ever after had been turned into a joke, and she felt like a laughing stock. Freddy took her hand and swung her round to face him.
A bet's a bet, and I'm a man of my word.
Laura pulled her hand away. In that moment, all the doubts about their relationship, all the fears of failure, and all the frustrations at her own imperfection converged to create a perfect storm.
Don't worry, she snapped. You don't have to wait until you've worked out a dignified escape route. I'm fully aware.